Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, folks, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to use my nickname today. I'm just going to go with Tony Pennycow.
What?
Okay. Dude, my nickname is not very popular right now, especially in the Midwest.
Oh, yeah. People are hating
my nickname. In fact, I think it was like Tuesday, I sent a guy that I used to work with, I sent him a happy birthday notice on Facebook, and he comments and he goes, "Thanks, Tornado." I said, "You might not want to use that word right now. You know, that word is not very popular." Or a month or whatever it was, because it's like hometown was leveled. And I was like, damn, I hope I don't go to a game and he sees me with like a shirt that says Tornado on it, you know, probably like wouldn't like throw a ball at my head.
Well, we have a lot going on tonight. I had to start the show a little late here because I was having some technical difficulties. Skype's trying to charge me for adding you to the call for some reason. Just goes to figure that every week seems right when I'm getting ready to start the show, if we're going to have difficulties, that's when it happens.
Of course.
Fine for like 15 minutes before the show. I had a nice green connection. Everything was good. And then the minute I had 3 minutes left till the start of the show and I tried to add you, and it's like, oh, you will be charged for adding this. And hopefully we're all set now. And we'll get Tom on in a minute. We've got a lot to talk about. A lot of big news. We had a big fight over the weekend with boxing and MMA, a couple big fights. I know Lucas Matisse had a pretty impressive performance, and they're talking all about trying to match him up with Floyd Mayweather now.
I know they're talking about possibly Danny Garcia because they're both at 140. And we'll get into it as we get time on, the call and we start discussing the fight in depth. And I'll tell you who made the best point about it was Paulie Malignaggi.
Yeah.
And, you got to think, right now, and Matisse said it best, he goes, we lost two fights that people don't think he lost. He lost Devin Alexander split decision, and I think it was Zab Judah majority decision, or vice versa. And he dropped both of those fighters. And a lot of people thought he won both fights. I mean, he literally could be 35-0. I think he's 33-2 with 31 knockouts. He could be 35-0. And he basically said, hey, now it just makes me realize that I just got to knock everybody out. And that's a scary thought for a lot of guys out there. This guy has bricks in his gloves. I mean, he was putting Peterson down the first time. He hurt him with glancing blows.
Right.
And then you saw what happened when he landed flush.
I didn't watch the fight myself, but I heard about it and I saw highlights anyway. But did not get a chance to watch it live.
Yeah, I didn't see it live either. I was out on Saturday, and then I came home and I watched it on Sunday. I mean, I got the message on my phone while I was out, and I was like, "Holy shit!" And then, wow, when I was talking to my dad, he's like, "No, you got to see this." He goes, "The hook that really destroyed him in the third round." He goes, "I didn't even see it." He goes, "They exchanged hooks." He goes, "And Peterson's was a little bit wider." He's like, which caught my attention, is next thing I know, he's flat on his back. And he's like, I didn't know what happened. He goes, I don't know if he stepped in with a right hand inside that wide hook. And he goes, I didn't realize they exchanged hooks. he goes, because I was focused more on Peterson's. And, you know, Steve Spoger gave him every opportunity to recover and defend himself. But he couldn't. I mean, and Matisse, he jumped right on him. It's a scary dude. I mean, they even showed Danny Garcia in the crowd. And I like Danny Garcia. We got him on our show. And you could see Danny was sitting there with that oh shit look on his face.
Wow.
For lack of a better term.
Right. We're going to make you happy tonight because we have a couple of good boxing guests for you. We have, first at 8:30, we're going to have Nicholas Sampson on. He's had a little bit of experience with the promotional and background of boxing. I don't think he's had any personal fighting experience himself, but he loves the fight game, and he's also a sales rep and sales manager at Liquid Lights. And they have a Lighten Up campaign that they're doing. Basically, the whole concept of the company is they make these drink koozies for, like, beers and drinks and stuff, bottles and cans, and glasses that have lights in them. They're powered by AAA batteries, I think, and lights up your drink, so makes you look cool. So anyway, they have a Lighten Up campaign that they're doing to try to give to different causes through their sales. And one of their first projects is going to be for Gerald McClellan.
Oh, wow.
Fighter who was, I think, not always fully paralyzed, but at least partially paralyzed from a fight with Nigel Benn.
Well, in fact, I remember that fight when it happened back in 1995. And first of all, it was very poor officiating over in England. Nigel had a reputation as being a very dirty fighter. He'd lead with his head, rabbit punch, hit guys on the ground. I think it was like Iran Barkley. When he stopped Iran Barkley, he hit him like three times on the canvas. In that fight, I don't know if Gerald didn't come in the best shape, where he had trouble making weight. But Gerald started really fast, and he had Nigel down and hurt. Had him out of the ring at one point. And then Nigel started like really leading with his head. And at one point, he came straight in with his head and literally slammed the top of his head into Gerald's face and his jaw. And you could see from there, Gerald seemed like he was out of it. And then, like, you know, his mouthpiece was hanging out for like the last few rounds of the fight. His mouthpiece was hanging out like he couldn't keep it in. And, you know, he seemed like he was really fatigued. And then finally, I think it was the 10th round, he just took a knee. And it's like I stopped. And then next thing you know, he'd be carted out of there. I know I read an article on Gerald a couple of years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago. And I remember the writer, and I believe it was for Ring Magazine, was talking about him. And, you know, they go over there, and Gerald is like 90% blind and like 90% deaf. I don't know if that's exactly accurate, but it's something along there where he really doesn't see and you really can't hear very well. So the whole time, it's like when you're there, he wants you to hold hands with him so he can feel that somebody's there. And he'll repeat the same things over and over. He'll say something like pat me, like, 2 times for yes and 1 time for no. And then they're still there, and you got to tap them. And like I said, I'm sure you can find this article somewhere. And then, like, his sisters take care of him. And, you know, they were getting him lunch, and, you know, they were, you know, going to get him, I think, like, Southern-style chicken one day, and the one type of drink that he likes. But, like, the whole time, he's always, like, so afraid, and he goes, are you still there? Are you still there? Hold my hand. And you feel bad for that, but you can tell that, you know, that fight did cause a lot of damage to him. And I remember seeing him fight live in Atlantic City before he even won the middleweight title, and it was pretty cool. I'll never forget it. It was the first really big card I went to, and this stablemate at the time, Michael Moore, was in the main event. And Gerald destroyed a guy by the name of Carl, the Irish Assassin Sullivan, who was didn't look too Irish. He was a little darker than a normal Irishman. Let's just say that way.
Well,
he was gone. He was gone for a while.
Just want to introduce Tom real quick.
Hey, Paul. All right, here we are. So, yeah, this is bringing back memories of that fight. A lot of stuff's available. Just Googling that. A lot of stuff. All the interviews. I remember the one you were talking about, how he just seemed, he was just holding the guy's hand. It was a sad story.
Yeah. Yeah, very sad story. Like I said, I remember seeing him live in 1992 before he really broke out a year later. Not Julian Jackson. And also, we can segue this almost back into how we started the show off, talking about Lucas Matisse last week. And I was saying I wanted to wait for Tom to get on to talk more about it. What Paulie Malignaggi said, and Paulie, and you can see Paulie was in the same weight class, he had the oh shit look on his face too, like, I don't want to be in the same building with this guy. He said, you know, Matisse is such a devastating puncher, and he's got a cast iron chin. He hits you, he hurts you. And like I said, he was hurting Peterson with glancing blows before he really, you know, put him down and out. And Malignaggi's like, it reminded him of Julian Jackson, who McClellan beat for his middleweight title. And it's like, yeah, Jackson was a devastating puncher, but he had a weak chin. So, you know, yeah, there was always the danger of, you know, him knocking you out. But then there was also the possibility that he would come in so wide open for his power shots that you could catch him, and he had a vulnerable chin. They said Matisse doesn't seem to have that problem. And like I said, Danny Garcia had the oh shit look on his face. Paulie Malignaggi came out and said, the two guys, the way you really got to be able to beat Matisse, he goes, you either got to be, I mean, a devastating, destructive puncher, or you got to be a tremendous boxer. Now, like I said, Matisse has losses, disputed losses, to Devin Alexander and Zab Judah. He had them both down, he had them both hurt. And a lot of experts think he won both those fights. He should be 35-0. Rich mentioned the name of a possible fight with Mayweather. I think Mayweather wins that relatively easily. I mean, yeah, there is the danger of the puncher's chance, but you got to look at a couple things here. Mayweather, in his fight, he's been between 137 and 154. Matisse is still 140. And you don't have, right now, maybe with the exception of a guy like Andre Ward, there is not a better pure boxer. And, you know, even including Andre Ward, I'm going to put it out there, there is not a better pure boxer in the game than Floyd Mayweather. And I think he would use Matisse's aggressiveness against him.
Yeah, I would agree. If he always has. He's always found a way to do it. And especially with that weight, yeah, when going up, you know how much punching power he'd lose.
Exactly. I mean, there are a few fighters that ever carried power up.
Exactly.
And I'm trying to keep on top of my head, you know. Julian Jackson carried hit from 154 to 160. But now you're talking to the guy that's got to carry from 140 to at least 147, if not higher. And I don't know if that would happen.
Well, I think Roberto Duran was a good example of what he was like at 135. And then at welterweight, he wasn't the one-punch knockout artist that he was. And then even at junior middleweight, he still had power. But it wasn't that same ferocity and devastation that he had at 135. You know, that one-punch ability.
He wasn't like he was putting guys out on the stretcher like he did with Ray Lampkin.
Right, exactly.
That was scary. I mean, I didn't really see it live. I was young, but I remember watching it on replays, and that was scary. And do you remember what Durant said after that fight?
Yeah, he said if I'd have trained hard, he'd be going to the morgue instead of the hospital. I think I'm paraphrasing, but something
right
along those lines.
Yeah.
Boy, that was it shows you where his mindset was then. You know,
you know what was funny. You know, I remember more Duran as he was getting older. I mean, I was still pretty young when No Mas happened. And then I remember the devastating knockout loss he had to Tommy Hearns. Then he had a respectable performance against Marvelous Marvin Hagler. I remember his fights with Iran Barkley. And then as he was getting older, I remember his fights with Vinny Pazienza. I mean, the first fight was competitive. He had Paz down. And it was close. The rematch, even Vinny said when we interviewed him a couple years ago, he goes, that was an instance of Roberto getting old fast. And that was 1995 because I was a freshman in college. And then 3 years later, he gets a title shot against Willie and Joppy. And you could tell you, I mean, he had to be his late 40s, early 50s by that time. And Joppy just tore him up. It was a middleweight fight. Joppy tore him up. They stopped it in the third round. And I just remember them walking Duran back to the corner. And he looked so old. And he just looked, you know, so human. And, you know, you could even see the anguish in his face. And I was actually mad at William Joppy, you know, for first of all, having that fight. I mean, it's not his fault, but I was mad at him. And then, but I was also mad at the sanction bodies for throwing Duran and to take that beating. And like I said, he looked so human with that, such anguish on his face after that fight. But the lasting memory I had of him was that mean, scowling Roberto Duran that I remember growing up was in Vinny Pazienza's corner in Paz's last fight against Tucker Pudwill. And obviously Duran was about 200 and some pounds at the time, but he had this big smile on his face, and he was cheering, and he was laughing. And I'm like, he didn't even look like the same guy anymore. And it was like, yeah, I guess age does mellow you out a lot.
Yeah, you kind of lose the edge.
Yeah. But and I mean, when we had Vinny on the show, I asked him about it. And I was like, yeah, I remember, especially the press conference going into that first fight with Duran was pretty nasty. And he goes, yeah, and he goes, you know, after the second fight, you know, Roberto's Rodlini was like really nice. And then after the second fight, he got old fast. He goes, he invited me, you know, there was a couple years later, to his 50th birthday party down in Panama. And the Panamanian people were so nice. And I couldn't understand them, but I had a good time down there. And then I said, I just remember him being in your corner for your 50th win against Tucker Pudwill. And it was like Roberto, he just seemed like a jolly elf. That's the way to describe it. That's how I'm going to describe him. He just seemed like a jolly elf. You know, he didn't have the beard anymore. He was clean shaven. And he was just smiling away. And I'm like, where's the scowl? I'm like, I don't even recognize this guy.
Yeah. You know, and I understand he became pretty good friends with Tommy Hearns. They had a relationship for a while.
Crazy.
I think they were, hanging out a little bit. And actually, he was a gentleman after that fight, but boy, that was a shocker. Summer, I think it was June of 84 when that happened. And, you know, I could understand Hearns winning, maybe, but not that utter devastation like that. That was just mind-boggling.
Because a lot of people, and especially because a group fight, you know, people always get the worst misconception of Tommy Hearns. Not that it's a bad misconception, but people always look at his two most famous wins, at least to me, would be the fight with Pepin Cuevas, which is a devastating knockout, the fight with Roberto Duran, which is a devastating knockout. Then I remember, you know, with fights with, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler, especially the Hagler fight, which was a war, one of the greatest 8 minutes in boxing history, maybe. But what people forget about Tommy Hearns is Tommy Hearns is an exceptional boxer. He just was a great boxer that had tremendous right-hand power. You know, a lot of people, you know, forget how skilled he really was.
Exactly. Well, I think we've seen that. You remember from the first Leonard fight. And that was quite a role reversal because everyone was expecting Hearns to come out and just be the killer. And Ray would be the boxer, and Ray was a bit behind. And then in the middle rounds, I remember Ray landed several body shots, and all of a sudden the whole dynamics of the fight changed. He went from predator to prey a bit. But he was showing an outstanding jab. His movement was great, and he had the fight won. But they were 15 back in those days, not 12. You know, that'd be an interesting show we could do sometime too. If all those fights were 12 rounds instead of 15, you know, sure would have changed history.
Well, we do have to talk a little bit about. Yeah, me too. Here, the show we could talk about boxing history all day with you guys, but we'll get to some more boxing talk later. We have a couple guests on. I forgot to mention we also have John D. Amadeo on in the second hour at 9:15. He's a boxing writer and well, a general writer, but he writes a lot about boxing. He's written some stuff on Ken Norton and former interview subject of mine named Rayco Saunders. One of my big articles around on the net on some other sites. BoxingScene.com has one article, I think, and another site has another article on. Or I think I interviewed him on MySpace at one time when I was MySpace blog. It was before Fight News Unlimited. But anyway. Later on. And of course, main event, Vitor Belfort beat Luke Rockhold. Just like Tom and I predicted, the experienced guy would win the day, and Luke looked very overmatched, and brought out a lot of talk about this TRT that Belfort's been doing, testosterone replacement therapy, and coincidentally enough, there was a reporter at the press conference after the card who asked about the TRT, and Vitor basically threatened to beat him up. So, of course, yeah. You know, the new conduct policy, he had to, apologize later, but he didn't get suspended or anything.
And that fight, there were a lot of interesting comments that, it's like the tinfoil hat crowd was out. Like, Luke, did you take a dive? Did you just allow him to kick you there? I mean, come on. It just, he just got caught. I mean, it happened.
Yeah. He didn't have much of an opportunity to show his game plan. 32 into the round, what happened. And, they were kind of dancing around each other and not really throwing much for, headhunting shots here and there. But, Vitor just knows how to throw that kick now.
That's a lot of evolution. Because, back in the old days, he never kicked much back in his early days, and he's really evolved. I noticed there they didn't touch gloves. I guess there'd been some words there. With my notes, I was saying Luke seemed very strong and very technically sound. And if you were a backer, his I liked what he was doing early on. But boy, did that change! Ooh. So the question now, where does Vitor go? That's interesting question. What his future will be.
As far as geographically, it seems like he's going to have to fight overseas for the most part because Nevada has pretty much already said they're not going to approve TRT for him because he's been busted for steroids in the past. So they don't want to give him a chance to overcome the damage done by steroids with this TRT. And they don't want to set a precedent of doing that for these guys that have been popped. So, it's been interesting listening to their routine and stuff about, who they could match him up against. It would have to either be a fellow Brazilian or, I don't know, they'd have to have it overseas somewhere where the UFC does their own testing and approval process. But I think actually having this fight in Brazil is a big motivator for Vitor, obviously. He really seemed to draw off that. He was just gaining power from the cheers of the crowd. And always looked buoyant, confident. Like, this guy was a prospect. Technically, the guy has less than half the amount of fights.
It also seems like that Strike Force curse is becoming a pattern that these guys come from Strike Force and adjust.
I would just say.
I just kind of made that up, but you know what I mean. We'll say a pattern.
I think it's just a result of the fact that there's a far less talent in Strike Force, it's obviously. Lower tier league, but then you have a guy like Ronaldo Souza in the co-main event, and he choked out Chris Camozzi pretty fast, and even though that Chris Camozzi isn't as experienced as Vitor Belfort, and he's kind of more of a UFC prospect, it's a pretty good, first the first round, he got him with an arm triangle choke.
Yeah, that was just almost magical the way he did that. I mean, you could it was almost like it was scripted, but what a magician he is.
Right. Then we had Rafael Dos Anjos beat Evan Dunham by unanimous decision. That was kind of a surprise, but Evan would have a better performance there.
Yeah, I would say about that one, I won't go as far as to say robbery, but did you notice the response of the Brazilian crowd? They weren't really overly enthused when the decision came out. And normally, you know, they're very nationalistic, which is cool. I understand that, but it was close enough though that I'm not going to say it was outright robbery. Just maybe a little bit of home cooking. My take on it.
Possibly, yeah. We have Rafael Natal beat Jao Zeferino, also by unanimous decision. I really didn't see much of that fight. And I also didn't see much of the Nick Lentz versus Hakran Diaz fight. It was also a unanimous decision for Nick Lentz. And I did read something. I didn't read the whole story, but saw a picture of Nick holding up his thumb. I guess the doctor cut his hand open when he was, got his thumb open or something, when he was taking the stuff off his hands, the wrappings, or I don't know what happened, but apparently the ring doctor cut him on the thumb. So, I wonder if that's covered under insurance. We'll see. And speaking of insurance, Gleison Tibau won over John Cholish, and I wasn't Cholish, but Cholish came out and said some things about fighter pay, and then on the heels of that, Jacob Volkman came out and just blasted the UFC's policy on health insurance. And I have a whole article about that we'll get to later. But Cholish came out right after the fight and retired and said that he doesn't want to do it anymore. It's not worth the risk, and the rewards are just not enough. He ends up pretty much losing money when he does these fights and has to travel and pay all of his staff.
Apparently, I believe Volkman said that there's a $1,500 deductible on the medical insurance. Well, I'm kind of scratching my head and thinking, all right, the minimum wage there is six to show and six to win. And I'm thinking a $1,500 deductible. What's up with that? And I had no idea, and I'm sure there's even more bad stuff that will come out about it. But
Yeah, and it's interesting that these other guys are all coming out at the same time. And we've also had, last week we talked about some issues with the Bellator payment system and some contract disputes. And you've got billionaires behind the UFC. They just started this new poker company, too. They're raking in the money already, the first online poker people in Nevada. Think they can afford to pay these guys what they're worth. And at the same breath, Bellator is run by Viacom, owned by Viacom, which is even probably worth more money than the Fertittas and all their combined interests. I'm not saying that officially, I could be wrong, but, you know, they're pretty well off, both of those, you know, owning partnerships there. So you'd think they could do a lot better for these fighters, but it was interesting because Cholish said, you always hear about how great they treat their fighters, but it's really only like the top 5% of their fighters, because the rest of their fighters
right.
are being screwed. Let's get back to the rest of the card. We're getting our guests on here any minute, but I want to get through the rest of the card. We also had Francisco Trinaldo beat Mike Rio, also by arm triangle choke in the first round. We had Paulo Thiago beat Michelle Richard Dos Prazeres. I don't know if I'm pronouncing any of that right, but except for the Richard part. That was a unanimous decision by Paulo Thiago win. Yuri Alcantara beat Iliarte Santos by knockout in the first round. And Fabio Maldonado beat Roger Hollett by unanimous decision. John Lineker beat Azamat Gashimov by TKO in the second round. Jussier da Silva beat Chris Carriasso by unanimous decision, and with just 13 seconds in to the third round, Lucas Martins won his the first fight on the card over Jeremy Larson by knockout punch. So there you have it, Dan. We're going to try to get Nicholas Sampson on the line with us. I mentioned before you got on the call, Tom, that Nicholas is working on a campaign through his company, Liquilite, to bring some attention to some major causes, community causes, actually some boxing causes as well, I believe. Hello. We're on delay here. Looks like we lost Tony, too.
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right. Well, I was saying the Lighten Up campaign by Liquilite was put together by Nick, who we're going to talk to any minute here. Got to add Tony back first. We somehow lost him. But he's going to help out Gerald McClellan. He's the first beneficiary of this Liquilite program, Lighten Up program. He's got some history. Nicholas has some history in boxing and in the promotional side of things, I think, background stuff. It's been so slow tonight. Slug. Come on. Anyway, we got UFC 160 this week, weekend as well. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but looking forward to that one. Some big heavyweight fights on the main event and co-main event. All right, folks, sorry about that. We'll get Tom back in a minute, but we're way overdue for our first guest, Nicholas Sampson, so I'm going to try to add him real quick. And once I get everything rebooted, we'll get Tom back on the line. I don't know what happened. I got kicked off the whole internet, not just Skype that time. Must be the cloud cover here. It's crazy tonight. I guess we had some real bad thunderstorms last night, but it's just raining tonight. So. Well, what's up with that?
Hello.
Hello, Nick.
Yes.
Hi, this is Rabble Rouser Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited.
How you doing, Rich?
We also have Tony Pennacal, whose nickname will go unsaid at the moment.
How you doing?
All right.
And then we have audience in a minute. We just had to reboot my system here because of the cloud cover. But anyway, we were talking a little bit earlier about your Lighten Up campaign through the Liquid Lights Company and your effort to help out Gerald McClellan. If you want to give us a little bit of a rundown on that, now's a good time for that.
Sure. First, a little bit about Liquid Lights, I guess. What they are is they're ready-to-drink koozies that have an LED light system embedded in the bottom. And when they are turned on, they will make any drink that's in a clear cup or bottle glow bright. So they're, you know, really a cool product. And based off of that, they call them the Lighten Up Campaign. L-I-G-H-T-E-N, Lighten Up Campaigns. And basically what they are is a campaign that will raise money and support the various causes that are in need in our communities. And I'm going to look to raise, you know, individual financial help, awareness, funds for research and development, and whatever else companies may need. My first campaign is going to be for Gerald. He's a professional boxing world champion. And in 1995, he fought Nigel Benn. And he came out of the fight with a blood clot in his brain. He was in a coma for 2 weeks. And when he came out of the coma, he was 100% blind and he had severe comprehension problems. So now he's in need of 24-hour medical care, which is extremely expensive. So we're working with his family to offset some of those costs.
We were talking a little bit about Gerald before we got you on the air and before we had some problems with our Skype. I was privileged enough to see him fight professionally live down Atlantic City about a year before he won the title from Jolene Jackson. And he was always one of my favorites because he was just such a, you know, he was a fighter's fighter. He would come out there on a seek and destroy mission every time. And I think, and I even said before we got young here that the fight with Nigel Benn was poorly officiated. It was over in England. You know, they gave Benn the benefit of the doubt when he was down and pretty much out. I think it was even maybe the first or second round. And then he was using his head liberally, which was part of the damage process that ended up putting Gerald in the condition he is.
Well, absolutely. Gerald was headbutted in the face, and right after that is when he actually took a knee and everything that happened. So absolutely, it was a poorly officiated fight. There was so much that happened behind the scenes in that fight. It was crazy.
And I remember even a couple of years after that happened, a friend of mine who I trained with, and I actually helped him get ready for his pro debut, fighting that in Philadelphia, and he was fighting a guy who was an Olympian from, I believe it was Egypt. And the Egyptian guy, who was much smaller than my friend, headbutted him in the face, broke my friend's nose, didn't get penalized, they stopped the fight and they awarded to the Egyptian kid. Okay, you know, a year or so later, this same kid fighting dirty like that again, and he was fighting a young 24-year-old kid from Kansas by the name of Randy Carver. The Egyptian guy's name is Kabari Salim. And he butted Carver in the face several times and ended up stopping him around 10 rounds, just like the McClellan fight. And Carver died. You know, he died from trauma to the head. And when you have people that blatantly, you know, okay, there's one thing about a low blow here, hold the arm or holding, you know, a little bit here. But there are other, you know, fouls that are dangerous fouls, one of them being using your head, and the other one being rabbit punches and things like that. Guys that liberally get away with stuff like that, it makes this dangerous sport more dangerous.
Of course. Now, do you think they're literally getting away with it, though, or is it that because that fighter is being protected and, you know, they realize that fighter may have a tougher fight on their hands than they need, and they're giving him a way out? You know,
well, I mean, going back to the Nigel Benn Gerald McClellan fight, obviously Ben was, you know, a fighter. He was, you know, from England. The fight was overseas, And, I mean, first of all, when Ben went down and out of the ring, now, Gerald may have punched himself out early in that fight because he was winging bombs from the start. And you could tell by the
sure.
rounds he was fatiguing a little bit. But he was, I mean, he had Ben down and out. And the referee gave Ben more time to recuperate than he really should have. But I think that was a situation where the hometown fighter was, you know, getting, you know, the benefit of the doubt. The situation with my friend, he was a guy that didn't have good managerial contact. He was kind of thrown into this fight against the guy that with a very extensive amateur career. Obviously, the guy was an Olympian, and who
sure.
they wanted to build up a little bit. So, yeah, they kind of turned the other cheek when he was throwing the headbutts in there. And then when my friend had his nose broken and he was unable to continue, it was ruled a TKO. If it was a more of an even playing ground, maybe where my friend wasn't thrown into a fight with basically no representation, it could have been a little bit different, but they knew who the cash cow was in this fight.
Well, of course.
When he fought Randy Carver, I can't really speak of because I didn't really know much about Carver. I'm going back about a good 13 or so years ago when this happened. But like I said, I don't know the whole situation there except that Carver was taking a beating. There was liberal use of the head, and he suffered, a fatal brain injury.
Yeah, that's horrible. You know, at the bottom line, the sport is a business, and it's about the money. And they're going to do what they can to protect their golden goose. And a lot of times it turns out to be ugly and controversial.
Yeah.
And that's what the fans complain about. And, you know, a lot of times it's not just bad judging. It's more so they already know who's supposed to win the fight. You know, I'm not saying that it's set, but I'm saying that they're protecting the fighter that's going to bring them the money. And I think, you know, in my opinion, a lot of these times if these judges and stuff want to keep working, they'll go with who they're told, you know, supposed to win these fights.
Before we get back to talking about Gerald McClellan, who, like I said, was a personal favorite of mine growing up.
Sure.
You'll get a real kick out of this one. Same fighter. I helped him get ready to train for his second pro fight. He had taken some time off after his nose broken, and he's going to come back. And once again, he was going to get kind of thrown out to the lions here. He was going to fight in Philadelphia. He was from Philadelphia against a Greek fighter who was a touted amateur and whose brother was promoting the show. So I go to the weigh-in. I had off that day, and I actually come home from college to see this. So I went to the weigh-in, and I go there. I see my friend Andre now. Andre was literally probably one of the nicest gentlemen you'd ever want to meet. But he looked nasty. You know, he looked like a Vander Holyfield. And he comes to this weigh-in in January wearing a big, like, overall, like, looking jumpsuit and a knit hat pulled down right through his eyes. And he looks nasty. Now, he unzips this jumpsuit and he gets on the scale. Now, he's cut out of granite. I mean, he looked like a little Vander Holyfield, you know, muscles rippling. And I was there when the Greek guy turns around and looks at his brother and says, I ain't fighting him. And now we're scrambling because this Greek fighter doesn't want no parts of this guy. And now they're trying to say, well, the Greek fighter, he's not going to fight Hunter. He's going to fight this other guy, but this guy failed the physical. And my friend Andre is going to fight a guy that was like 7-1. Andre's 0-1. And we're like, and finally the manager who threw him to the wolves before said, you know what, this is wrong. And not only am I not taking this fight, but you're not also cutting me out of the short money because we had a counter fight with this guy who was being so promoted and they were going to have Greek belly dancers there to promote the fight. And so we're getting on the elevator to leave. You know, our fight got canceled. And we get on there and we see another guy standing there and he's pissed off about something. And the manager goes, oh, are you here to fight tonight too? He goes, no, my fight got canceled. I was supposed to fight, turns to my friend, puts his finger in his face, said, you, but apparently you're too scared to fight me. And we're like, whoa, 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 that's not the whole story. You know, we're turning it around, and this is a guy who was 7-1. Now I'm in the middle of a fist fight on an elevator. And
oh boy,
the papers came out the next day. In the whole story, that the Greek fighters' opponent failed to make weight. They tried to get him a replacement, and that guy failed the eye exam.
Wow. Hey, Stalin, how you spin it, right?
Yeah, I was right. And I was a journalism major, so I know all about, you know, media bullshit.
Right.
But I was right there in the weigh-in and the managerial meetings when it all happened. And I read that paper, and I said, I think I still have it somewhere. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Oh, yeah. I've seen some crazy stuff at some of these fights. Crazy stuff.
Well, obviously, let's talk about, you know, what we were originally discussing. You first said, you know, with the injuries that Gerald McClellan suffered in that fight with Nigel Benn. And I was saying, I read an article, I think it was in Ring Magazine, probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And even the writer that was saying when he went in there, you know, Gerald is almost afraid to be alone sometimes because he doesn't have that sensory perception. He's, you know, almost completely blind. He's almost completely deaf. And so when someone's in there with him, he almost requires him to hold his hand at all times and to tap his leg for yes or no.
Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of information that's gone on about Gerald since he's been hurt, and some of it's not true. Gerald is not almost completely deaf. Gerald has severe comprehension problems. And that is one thing that his sister, Lisa McClellan, wants people to know. He may have lost about 20% of his hearing. There's a lot of reports that say he lost about 80%. Not true. But he is blind. Another thing is, you know, there is quality of life for Gerald. You know, I mean, I've been on the phone several times with Lisa when he's in the background, and they're having fun, joking around. You know, so there is definitely quality of life there for him. It's not all what we hear. And that's another thing that she really wanted people to know about him, is that he is happy. But there is a big stress on them, you know, for the finances that come with his medical care. So that is what our company is trying to help, you know, alleviate.
Now, Nick, can you tell us a little bit about how you first started following boxing and, you know, what got you into the sport in the first place?
Sure. When I was a kid, I used to watch boxing with my dad a lot. We were both, you know, big boxing fans. And then when I was young in school, maybe fourth or fifth grade, I was very small. So he got me into boxing and self-defense. And I had several amateur fights, and I was doing really well. But my eyes are bad, and I started having some serious problem with my eyes. And basically, we pulled the plug on it before I had, you know, irreparable problems. So after that, when I got old enough, I started going to fights, and I just wanted to be involved in the fight industry, and I'd start introducing myself to anybody I could. And I'd, you know, meet referees and commentators and ring announcers and different fighters and stuff, and I just started letting people know that they'd be seeing me around the fights. And basically, you know, I met the right people, and I started working. I did some work with a good friend of mine, Mr. Tim Witherspoon, after he retired, with some of the fighters that he was working with and some of the projects that he had going on. And from there, it just brought on other opportunities.
All right. I also wanted to let you know that we have Psychic Tom on the line.
Oh, I'm back.
Psychic.
Hello.
But, Nick, I have to tell you, I charge for lottery numbers, okay? So,
gotcha.
Yeah, Nick, tell us also, what is it that you would say you like most about boxing as a sport?
You know, I enjoy it. I enjoy being around it. I enjoy the atmosphere. I love being at the fights. It just, I know the atmosphere of it is fantastic. I appreciate the athletes and all the work that they put into getting ready to fight. You know, I don't like a lot of the business parts of the sport, but purely as a fan, I love it. I love the fights. I love the atmosphere.
Awesome. And do you have a favorite fighter?
You know, Gerald was always one of my favorite fighters. I was always a big fan of Marvin Hagler. You know, DeMarcus Chap Corley, who I know you had on your show recently, is a very good friend of mine. I really enjoy watching him fight. I got to say, Gennady Golovkin is really, I really enjoy watching him fight now, too.
Oh, yeah. I actually, one of his last friends, I know he knocked out the Japanese kid just a matter of weeks ago, but a few months ago when he fought Gabe Rosado. I know Gabe, a Philadelphia fighter. I've covered Gabe's fight a couple times. And
tough kid.
Yeah, very tough kid. And his trainer, Billy Briscoe, who got, you know, a lot of praise on HBO for stopping that fight when he did because he needed to. I've known Billy for about close to 10 years now. And Billy's a hell of a nice guy. I was just talking to him a month or so ago with a fight card in King of Prussia. And even I said to him there, it's like, you know, Billy, I mean, first of all, he's done such a great job with Gabe. And Billy's finally getting the recognition he deserves, but it showed his compassionate side, too. I mean, as a good trainer, I mean, you need that. You need to be able to push your guy, you know, because hey, there's sometimes, you know, you got to fight through pain. And there's sometimes you got to turn around and say, you got to be compassionate. You got to do the Eddie Futch thing and say, sit down, son. Nobody will forget what you did here today.
Absolutely. You know, we guys got to realize the difference between just winning a fight or having a chance to win a fight and have a chance to live a normal life after the fight and after your career.
Right.
You know,
it had
I mean.
We had gotten to the point where you know Gabe didn't have a chance to come back.
Well, you know, anything can happen. I mean, honestly, you know, there could be an injury in the fight and all of a sudden, you know, he had a chance to win. But it's fluke, you know, and the risk versus reward there was not worth it to continue.
Right.
Now, what would you say is the biggest problem boxing has right now that needs to be fixed?
Oh, on a political end, I just think the way that these fighters are treated is sometimes absolutely crazy. I mean, they're put into situations that, you know, I mean, at the best situation, if a fighter can concentrate on what they're supposed to concentrate on, which is to train and get ready to fight and not have to worry about the business end of the sport or what's going on with their team or what's being done, you know, they have the best chance to go in the ring and be safe and hopefully come out with a win. But if there's all this garbage and political stuff going on around them and they're drug into it to where they're not concentrating on what they need to be concentrating on, it's horribly dangerous for them. And really just the political end of it, I think, really could be cleaned up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, aside from these bad decisions and stuff, I mean, these people, it's their career. I mean, you know, you fight a great fight and lose a bad decision, it hurts your opportunity financially in a sport. But even more so, just the politics in general. It's horrid sometimes.
Well, Nick, I think you've done a great job of identifying the problem, but as far as solutions, you know, like we'll see on Friday Night Fights so often that we get these ridiculous decisions, you know, the hometown decisions that we alluded to earlier, some of the questionable refereeing, and Teddy Atlas will come on and talk about a national commission. So my question to you is, first off, do you think that would ever happen? And second, do you think that's the answer, bringing more government into it? What do you think?
Absolutely. I think it could be the answer as long as it's done properly. You know, so far what we've seen about people coming up with fighters unions or fighter associations has, in my opinion, really missed, dropped the ball when they're coming up with their ideas. There's so many things that they could be doing to garner support that they're not. That I think if done properly, absolutely. You know, I think also these fighters need to have teams around them that they can trust. And there's so many dishonest and dirty people in the sport that if these guys can find people to place around them that they can trust to do their jobs, there's a much better chance. And, you know, of course, these people also need to let, you know, the judges, the promoters know that they're not going to be in shooting. Basically, I think a lot of times the fighters were more vocal and basically, you
know, creative percussion for some of these bad decisions, that, you know, his promoters and judges would be less likely to pull that on them again, you know. But there's no repercussions for it. And a lot of times, maybe they speak out for a day or two, or, you know, create a little video, and then it's done. If they would really push the issue and really make it a big ordeal, the chance of them getting screwed the next time would be a lot less.
No, it's an interesting point, because you'd think they ought to have something for the management side, too, like fines. Like, fighters get busted for, you know, banned substance or something. Sometimes they get fined and bound for their purse, in addition to being suspended. Maybe it would be a good idea to start suspending and fining some of these promoters for their activities, some of these managers for putting their fighters in bad positions.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Everything should be looked into. There should be an organization, like you brought up before, that would, you know, support the fighters and look into all of those situations and really protect the fighters. I do believe that. It just has to be done properly.
All right. Well, we're hitting up to about 9:15 here, and we got to get John Amadeo on. You know him.
John's a fantastic writer.
Tell us a little bit about how you met him.
Well, actually, I used to work with a fighter named Rayko Saunders at one point, Rayko War Saunders, and John wrote Rayko's life story. And the book really wasn't about Rayko as a fighter so much as what he went through in his personal life, from finding his mother deceased of a drug overdose at 10 years old, to growing up in the streets and overcoming the Pittsburgh crack wars. It's an intense story, a lot of legs to it. If people would actually pick it up and read it, they wouldn't be able to put it down. It's a great story. John's a great writer. Actually, Rayko wrote part of that book as well. And they did a fantastic job with it. I would imagine that eventually you'd see that as a movie.
All right. Well, do you have anybody you want to give a shout-out to, say hello to, thank you?
Well, I'd definitely like to give a shout-out to DeMarcus Chop Chop Corley, as well as my Liquid team. Rich, I definitely want to thank you, too, for your help in helping us get the word out about these Lighten Up campaigns. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome. We definitely appreciate having you on, and, you know, we'll keep the word going around about this, and hopefully we can get some help from Daryl and, you know, get some funds for his treatment and care.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Best of luck, Nick.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
You're welcome.
All right.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Hey, there's Nicholas Sampson, and we're going to connect to John Amadeo here any second. Just get him up here on Skype.
Biography, and he's still actively boxing, you know. He'll be, I think, 39 this year.
Yeah, and I know when I talked to him, he had just had one of those really bad decisions he seems to get drawn to.
Oh, yeah, he's got a string of bad luck, I think, made by some of these decisions were not the greatest. They weren't in his favor, that's for sure. And he was here last year in New York at the Roseland. And he went the distance, but cards were stacked against him. He was against a local guy out in Long Island. And, but, you know, he went the full distance, and you got to give him credit for that. And he's been around a while, and he's been through a lot, as you indicated, an awful lot. Nice guy, though. Really got to know him well. Very good, decent guy. Raising his own son. Pretty decent man.
Yeah, I remember him talking about his son, bringing him into the gym, and he's even as a little kid, he was a natural hitting the bag and stuff. Before not many.
Yeah, well, the book Blessed for Curse, which is, you know, which we co-authored, really talks a lot about, you know, some of the problems he had growing up in Pittsburgh, and the tragedy with his mom, and then turning his life around after going in and out of prison. And today, you know, he's in Africa, and you know, he's even cited, I think, the last year, a year before, by the mayor of Pittsburgh, for doing such good work and helping with the Golden Gloves, and his young son, his oldest son, rather. He's involved with the Golden Gloves right now, as far as I know. That's, and I've been talking around on a pretty regular basis. A regular guy, down to earth, you know. And we become friends as well.
Cool. And you also wrote a lot about Ken Norton, too, right?
Yeah, Ken's book was, you know, more sanitized because I could, you know, really work through and only through his manager at the time. And, but it really didn't deal with his boxing career as much as his life and how he had to cope with the really catastrophic accident, the car accident that he had off the Santa Monica Freeway, and how he had to adjust to a lot. And you know, really as a person who now had some real challenges, physical challenges in life, and a pretty positive guy, though, really quite still an impressive man. And you know, I had the luxury of going out there, meeting him and visiting with his family and being out there in California where he lives. But, you know, his book was pretty much based on the aftermath of that crash, and we used a little biography and stuff like that. But what I liked about Ken was that, you know, I got invited down to Washington. In November they have, I guess they still have it, they have Fight Night, they call it, and, you know, they donate the proceeds to children with cancer. And in one of those events, about 3-4 years ago, most released that, they had, they honored Ken, so they invited me down. It was really very impressive, very, very nice. And I got to meet a lot of the big people from the boxing world, you know, from Ernie Shavers to Sugar Ray, and Jake LaMotta was there. It was really quite nice.
Cool. And how did you first get into writing about boxing in the first place?
It's interesting because this was, you know, thank God for the internet. And Rayco was, you know, I think he was friending me on MySpace and indicated that he wanted, that he was sending out a feeler of anybody who wanted to write. So I wrote back and told him I had finished a book. It was a fictional book about the neighborhood I live in here in New York, Hell's Kitchen. And he got interested in it, and that kind of snowballed into his book eventually, you know, with a lot of bumps along the way. You know, he got arrested, and, you know, we were corresponding during that period until he got exonerated. And that's how it really started. And with Ken, the same way, his manager was actually gave me he sent out a message to, in general, and he said if anybody could call this number, and I did, and we got to speak to Ken directly on a conference call, and he wanted me to come out there and meet him. So it just worked that way, just, you know, by string of luck, I guess. So that's how it happened.
Cool. And what do you enjoy most about boxing as a sport?
Well, it was a challenge, you know. The thing I liked about, I learned a lot by doing the research and by speaking with and having interviews with them. And just, you know, it's just very, very challenging. And you know, you learn a lot about the good and the bad and everything else that goes along with it. And some of the highs and lows and the people that were trying to take advantage of others and, you know, the usual messy stuff that happened, but also the good stuff as well. The main thing is the individual personality, the person who rises to the top and can really make a, not only a name for himself, but, you know, really can impact. Everybody has a story, you know, and people are gravitated towards boxers. They like those stories, and they're interesting because everyone is unique. And, you know, the movies that come out, like the Fighter and Stone M on Ricky Ward and them, they're all pretty lucrative, and they're also very interesting, even with the female boxers and mixed martial arts now, too. So, you know, as an individual sport, it's still, I think, you know, one that's a love-hate relationship with a lot of people, too, because of the brutality in the ring, et cetera. So, it's fascinating, in a word, so it's good. You know, it's good to write about it.
Yeah. And when did you start writing?
I'm sorry?
When did you actually start writing?
I started writing about 6-7 years ago after I retired as a teacher. I was in the school system for 30 years. I was assistant principal, and then I retired and had a lot of time on my hands. And I started writing, and I was actually taking care of my mom for a while, going upstate to see her up in upstate New York. And gave me a lot of time to, you know, leisure time, which I wanted to use, you know, productively, not just sit around. So I started writing the first book, Voices of Hell's Kitchen, which was really a series of short stories about some of the crazy people in the neighborhood, some of the personalities, from dog walkers to the writers. And I used the first chapter, a fictional character of a boxer, and that a lot of people liked that first chapter. And that's how it started, just kind of mushing from there, and just use my imagination a bit.
Yeah, actually, now that you mentioned the title, I think you sent that to me at one point. We must have communicated, because I have that book, and you sent it to me.
You have, which book is that?
The Voices of Hell's Kitchen.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, Nick Sampson has that, and I think he's got all my books in fact. The last one I just finished, in fact, it just came out a couple of weeks ago, which is another, it's a fictional book about an immigrant coming to New York, getting the height of the potato famine, and obviously coming here to Hell's Kitchen and making something of himself after a stint in the Civil War. So that is the captain's coin. That's out there now, in fact. It's on Amazon now. And I just like writing, I guess, so, you know. Not the best writer, but it gives me space. It gives me time to contemplate, and you know. And we have our own little group here of writers, and we kind of came together, and we do periodic readings in our community room, and it's it makes for a good social evening, you know, good chatting, you know.
Yeah, I can't recall when that happened, but I know I must have been communicating with you at some point. Or something.
Yeah,
the social networks there, because same story about how I met Rayco, I think, was on MySpace. That's how I got a lot of my early interviews to start my website and then the radio.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether I interviewed you or wrote about you before, just contacted you and sent it to me.
The Rayco story would make a good movie, really, because it's got a bit of everything. It's got to be a tragedy and triumph, along with, you know, the human story, the human element of, getting really a bad situation and turning it around and making something of himself. And, I respect Rayco as a result of that. You know, he's tough, but he's determined, and, you know, and he's a good guy, you know, unlike some of the people that you come across sometimes. He's not a phony.
Yeah, he's definitely got some inspirational qualities. It's just...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, he wrote a lot of the book himself. He wrote a lot of when it really got really dicey with the police confrontations and you know, he was my angel, you know, hustling and dealing drugs on the street, and eventually he turned his life around, as they said, but he brings that all out there. He doesn't close anything, and he even opens the book, Blessed or Cursed, with was really a challenge, saying that if anybody wants to challenge me on any of the facts in this book, I welcome them to take a polygraph, you know. And it's been out there 4 years, and no one has come forward, so it's pretty factual what he wrote. And as I said, he did a good job, because he wrote a good 30-40% of the book is his, you know, the chapters that, especially dealing with the incarceration and some of the other problems he had.
Yeah, I know that it got kind of involved in another controversial issue, too, a few years ago. I remember reading about him in the papers, because he was, or online anyway, from the newspaper websites, where he was involved with the No Snitching campaign there in Pittsburgh, and they had T-shirts and everything, No Snitching, and I thought, you know, this isn't a good message to send, and then I started reading his comments, and I never actually realized what they mean, you know, snitching. It's not just, you know, it's not at all like don't tell if you see a crime happening. It's not about that. It's about these guys that get recruited.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense what you're saying, because Reiko's book, I remember him telling me this is not a story about a boxer, it's a story of my life, and I happen to gravitate towards boxing, and, you know, it kind of saved him, I think. I'm sure it did. But it's really, he says the story of my life and turning it around, and certainly the boxing is a major component of it, but, you know, he said it's not a boxer story, it's a story of my life, and I like that about him. You know, he wanted to make that perfectly clear, which I said fine, because I didn't know damn thing really at the time either about him or even about the sport in general, to be honest. So it was good. It was an education for me as well. So we got along well, too, which was helpful. And as a little kid, you know, I always brought him a little present, so there's always, every time I went out there was always something I had to give to the kid. It was a major component of getting out there at least two or three times. And I managed to get out there about five or six altogether by the time we finished it all. And plus, we were emailing back and forth and comparing notes with the chapters. And then I would have somebody edit it for me. A friend of mine is a good editor. So we finally got it together and we got it published. And it has legs. I think, as I said, it would make a hell of a story. It had a good movie, in fact. So hopefully some screenwriter will hear this and you'll want to look at it, you know.
Screenwriting isn't actually that hard. You get a hold of a script.
Yeah. Well, we have Rachel is a good hustler still, and he knows some people out there. And I also, ironically, my dentist's son is out there in Hollywood, and I sent him a copy of the book, and he likes it. So we'll see where it goes.
Right.
And you know, like anything else in life, it take on a life of its own. You know, a lot of these projects do that. And I find you can't close the door to anything. You know, just get out there, tell the truth, and the truth is going to come out anyway. So, and just tell it like it is. And I think that's a sign of not only writing, but in life. You got to, you know, face up to the facts and tell what happened, both the good and the bad, to yourself, and not be afraid to let it out. You know, and Rico does that. He does it pretty well in his book.
Yeah, one of the kind of funny stories he told me that I always remember is how I asked him at one point, you know, what challenges did you face managing yourself? And he said, well, to give you a case in point, one day I was really trying to go out there and sell tickets for my fight. And you know, I was hustling so much, I was driving all over the neighborhood and around the city and always hitting the brake and hitting the gas back and forth, you know, and so come fight time, all of a sudden, my right foot is killing me, and, you know, my whole right leg is tired. So he actually had problems in the fight. He won the fight, I think, but you know, just had a hell of a problem just getting around the ring half the time because he was so busy selling tickets for his own fight. I guess one of the pitfalls of managing yourself, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I think Reiko sustained an injury when he was in. I think he was playing basketball when he was in jail, and there was no medical attention. We have it in the book. He wrote that chapter. He explains it very well, how the doctor really just didn't pay any attention to him. He ended up you know, what's really a serious problem. I think it was an Achilles heel. And, you know, that takes forever to heal. And it was bad. And, you got to have the whole body ready for it if you're going to go into the ring, that's for sure. But I think even David Hayes, when he fought Rocky Clutcho, he complained about something like that. He blamed that. Yeah, he blamed something. He had a problem with his foot, but the foot had to go on because the push was so big. I remember reading that. It's interesting. So you got to, you know, you're a commodity and you're worth it. You're up to, you're going to be worth a lot of money to whomever is managing you and promoting you. So, like, it makes sense, of course, yeah.
Well, I got two other hosts here who haven't been piping up, so any one of you guys got any questions?
Well, that's the one thing I was going to say. You just mentioned it. I remember when you wrote that one story on Rako a couple of years ago, and then I know you interviewed him before I was the co-host. I think we both interviewed him on one of our shows. But that's what I remember you saying was the one time he was saying, trying to just help trump up interest for the show, he wore himself out not even training, just, you know, by sitting in the car, and he said his legs were dead. I remember even watching him on ESPN, and just so much talent, and it was just one thing missing. I remember he lost the decision that night. I don't remember who he fought. It was on ESPN, but you talked about it the night before, and you know there's all that talent, and you just said, it was just one thing missing. It always makes me think of, you know, him killing his legs in the car.
Yeah, that fight, you know, I think I forgot who he was fighting that day. I did see that fight. Yeah, he was just out of prison then, so he was still a little rusty in there, but he went the whole distance on that. I remember that.
Yeah.
This is going back, I would say, at least 4 or 5 years, isn't it?
Probably, yeah. That would be around the time that I would have interviewed him last.
That's when Nick was managing him. I was with Tim City, I think, at that time. He had fought Henry down in Houston, and he actually won that fight, but that's it. For the local boy at that point.
Yeah, that was the one that he was talking about.
That is the one, yeah.
And Vander Holyfield was ringside and everything, and told him that he won the fight. And actually, mm-hmm. I think Henry ended up getting a huge medical suspension because he beat him up so bad. Rako didn't get anything. So,
yes.
So it's like laying out all the evidence why he should have won that fight. I think at one point he's like, yeah, my record really should be this instead of this. All these fights keep adding up.
Yeah, that's one for the books. Rako always talks about that when you bring it up and how he really got screwed down there in Houston, you know, by the local officials or whatever, you know, and the Texas Boxing Commission, whomever, whoever was pulling the strings. And he really won that fight for sure. But, you know, he manages to come back, you know. He's got... Not a stellar record, but he's got a lot of fights under his belt. And so Nick knows pretty much a lot. He knows his personality, too. He knows it can be very tough. But he says he's very straightforward. And I, as I said, I like the guy because of that.
Right.
You know, he's not a phony.
Yeah. He's got a very smooth-talking ability, you know.
He's very easygoing to talk to.
He is.
Good to have a
conversation with,
because,
you know, there's never a quiet moment.
quite a lot of stories to tell, believe me. You know, I can't really expand on too much here, but there's quite a lot to tell. It's in the book, though. He talks about all the, you know, forays he's had and some of the people he's met, some of the ladies he's had. It's interesting. It's an interesting read.
Now, how do people find your books? Is it on Amazon and all that?
What's that?
How do people find your books? Can they get them on Amazon and stuff like that?
Yeah, those books are all on Amazon, and I think Barnes & Noble, they're on, too. Yeah, they are. Ken Norton's book is called Believe, Journey from Jacksonville, and that is both on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Draco's biography, Blessed or Cursed, also is on Amazon and also on Barnes & Noble. And my other two books, my fictional books, are as well. Yeah, so you're pretty much out there.
Now, do you have any? Have you followed boxing for a long time, or did this just kind of develop through your writing that you became a boxing fan?
Well, you know, I go back to when I was a kid in the 50s. Friday night was pizza night, pizza and beer night at the house. So everybody used to watch what was called the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports, you know, and from the old Madison Square Garden in New York on 50th and 8th Avenue. In fact, I live 8 blocks from it now. It's a huge high rise today. What else is new in New York, you know, with the developers. And you know, people fought there from Marciano on and used to watch it all the time. In fact, I remember the fight when I was a kid with Emil Griffith and Benny Perrette, was it? Benny Kid Perrette?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, the one that he ended up getting killed. And I remember that night. I was just probably 12, 13 years old at the time. And Emil, I'd seen the neighborhood here a couple of times and approached him. And, you know, he wasn't too well the last couple of years. But I'm going back about 4 or 5 years. So we sat down and talked for a while. Nice guy. But he hasn't been well, I guess, in the last couple of years. What I understand from Eddie Montalvo, Camacho's cousin, and who's a friend of mine as well.
And so I imagine you still follow boxing today?
Yeah, pretty much. I you know, a lot of people that, you know, when I go to the gym, a lot of the guys, the older guys, I'm talking about the older guys that are in their 40s and 50s, but from the time, you know, the ones that Tyson and Holyfield in that era, they want to have a heavyweight champ in the United States, you know, and with the Cultural Brothers, they've been, you know, have been challenged, but, you know, they still maintain it. And a lot of the guys also feel that the mixed martial arts, there's more money in that now. People are gravitating towards that. People that were in boxing or that were interested in promoting things are going over to mixed martial arts and some of that because it has a good draw on TV, of course, you know. In wrestling, of course, but the old timers. So when the ones that I talk to, they really, and we'll talk about Tyson especially, and Holyfield and some of the others, and some of the other weight categories like Sugar Ray and them. So it's a good mix, you know, a good social mix when we meet and talk about that. But they want the heavyweight championship back here in the States. And, you know, something to be said about it. I think the sport will be rejuvenated once we get somebody. And, you know, there's a few people coming down the pike right now. A guy from Delaware, Amir Moyer, I think he called himself now. He's like 16-0 undefeated. So I think he works out of Delaware, and I guess he'll get to Vegas one of these days. And whenever somebody, you know, sees him coming along and is a good prospect. Somebody's got to be out there. Somebody's got to be there.
Well, there's also George Foreman's son, Monk.
Yes. Monk. Yeah. Yeah.
He's 18.
That's right. Yeah.
And on top of what's with the
woman bosses a lot of them too, and you know, I don't know too much about them, but he seems to be staying the course with it. So.
Right.
You know, there's a lot to be said about it, and, you know, it's a fascinating sport, and, you know, it's all about the people, it's all about personalities and people around, and, you know, all about the hustle, let's face it, you know, that's what it is.
Yeah. And is there any, is there anybody you want to give a shout-out to, say hello to, or thank before we let you go?
That's right, to Rayco and to Ken Norton. And also, you know, to Junipino's in the Philippines, and Papio's, this is actually his artist and his project manager. They took me out to lunch when I was in San Diego last year. So, they're listening. Hello to them. But I don't know if he's in the States now, right now. But those are some of the people I know. And Eddie Montalvo certainly down in Florida.
Awesome. Well, we definitely enjoyed talking to you, and
well, thank you for giving me this opportunity. It's been great.
Yeah, we'll definitely plug your books when we post this this on our
group. Oh, thanks. Thanks. It's really kind of you. Thanks. I appreciate that.
I'll definitely check it out. I'll probably buy the Rayco one at least myself, because I'd love to read more about his story, having that connection.
Yeah, it's a good read. It's a good read. He deserves it, too, because he's a good guy. Look, I have a great chat with you, and I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Okay.
All right. You have a good night.
You too. Thanks a lot. Ciao.
All right. So we got, that's John V. Amadeo, by the way. Not to be confused with the other John Amadeo out there. I know when I try to do some research on John, there's another guy who happens to be a medical writer, I think. Got all kinds of health and wellness books out there. So just when you do your search for him or his books, make sure you put the V in there. That'll help. So we definitely have a lot left to cover. With only about 15 minutes left to go, so I'm going to try to speed through some of these stories I have. But I'm going to start with one that's kind of interesting. And I know there's already a Tony the Tiger, but I think after you listen to this, Tony, you might want to change your nickname to Tony the Tiger. anyway, so here's a story. From Moscow, there was a fight over the weekend. Guillermo Jones is kind of in a little bit of controversy, even though it's probably unwarranted. Because a former champion has accused him of doping to give himself unnatural stamina in his knockout win over Denis Lebedev. And according to this piece, Jones, 41 years old, reclaimed the belt when the referee stopped the fight in the 11th round. And that belt is the WBA cruiserweight title. The referee stopped the fight in the 11th round after Lebedev was knocked down on Friday. At the time, the Russian was leading on all three scorecards and had landed some heavy shots on Jones despite fighting with a bruise the size of a tennis ball around his right eye. Jones's fortitude in resisting Lebedev's punches was abnormal, said former International Boxing Organization super bantamweight champion Dmitry Bakhtin, who was ringside. And he says, quote, "I reckon that Jones was on something. Obviously, the medical commission needs to get involved. This test will show everything." And Bakhtin retired unbeaten in March and suggested that Jones would have fallen under Lebedev's onslaught unless he had used some kind of banned substance. After the fight, there were some reports that claimed Jones had refused a scheduled doping test. But the WBA executive, Gilberto Mendoza, insisted the new champion had taken the test. Jones himself put his victory down to determination, revealing that he told himself he was a tiger during the fight to increase his motivation. So believe you're a tiger, and I guess you can be the champion. but the Panamanian's punch resistance was widely praised, including by WBA heavyweight regular champion Alexander Povetkin. Myself, he says, I went crazy with how Jones was taking those shots and not falling, especially because there wasn't a bruise on his face. That definitely affected Dennis psychologically. The victory for Jones has his record improved to 39-3 with 2 draws and 31 knockout wins. And Lebedev slips to 25-2. So there you go. Release the tiger within you. It will happen. Now, there's another story here. Talked a little bit earlier about John Cholish. I have another story somewhere here about Jacob Volkman. Well, before I mention that, I wanted to quickly go over a new signing for Bellator, Matt Riddle. Apparently, his contract with Legacy Fighting Championship, which he signed shortly after leaving the UFC, being thrown out for marijuana use. There's no suspension involved, I guess, because it was overseas. They don't have commissions where he fought, so apparently he doesn't get suspended for by any American commission. So he's going to jump right into the welterweight tournament there in Bellator. And it was bought out in a deal they couldn't refuse, according to LFC promoter Mick Maynard. The exact terms and conditions of the contract buyout are unknown, but Bellator officials haven't made much comment on it. And Riddle's excited to get right back into it and get into that tournament. Let me find this Volkman story. John Solis' story here. I wanted to get us some quotes of his in too. All right, just for a basic example, he says, so Danny Castillo, I know, trains out of California. He had to travel to New Jersey for a bout with me. I live in New York. I had to travel to Brazil. You're fighting in a sport, mixed martial arts, with a wide range of skills and tactics, and a lot of people will have multiple coaches. You're allowed 3 corners for each fight, but you're only in your contract. For me personally, I only get 1 coach's flight and 1 hotel room. Cover 1 visa. I know from just this last fight, I had to pay over $3,000 in flights. I had to pay for an additional hotel room. I had to pay for 2 additional visas, which are $500 apiece. I had to pay for the licensing fees. I had to pay for the medicals. Chola said he made $8,000 for a Saturday bout. He estimates once you factor in costs required simply to travel to Brazil with his team, he's in the whole $5,000 to $10,000. Before you even step into the ring, your original purse is gone, Charles claimed. And that's before factoring in the gyms I go to train in and my coaches that take hours of time to sacrifice. I want to pay them and take care of them. It just seems like certain things could be handled better and the fighter could be treated better for an organization that claims to be the best in the world in mixed martial arts. And just says pay the fighters more. He also says, I can say from how I've been treated indirectly and just my understanding of what I think the UFC takes in on an annual basis, they could compensate the lower level fighters, and without going into detail, the upper level fighters a little bit better. I think if you're a fighter on the lower level, you should at least be getting enough income, win or lose in your fight, so that in a 3-month period of time or 2-month period of time, whatever the fight camp may be, you can go into that fight fully focused on the fight, performing your best as opposed to worrying about, man, you know, financially, how can I prepare? Cut corners? And Cholish is actually an Ivy League college graduate. He's involved in the stock market for a day job. And it was a perfect time, I guess, for him to walk away because of these payment issues and because he has that side job. But a lot of these fighters don't have that to fall back on. You know, now that he's out of the UFC and he's had these problems, it seems like he's definitely going to become a cheerleader for change and get something done here and maybe really put his money where his mouth is since he's making enough outside the sport to kind of be a little bit of a lobbyist for this. And this is the second interview that I grabbed off the net that he spoke about this. So it's, you know, it's kind of one thing that you wish these guys would talk about while they're still in the UFC, but it's hard to get them to say anything bad about the organization while they're in it. I know we've had a bunch of UFC fighters on the show that we've always tried to get them to say something, and, you know, a few of them have been brave enough to go out on a limb, but it's not very often.
Yeah, most of them want to keep their job.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and that's sad. Obviously, I've always been more of a boxing guy. But that's the thing that, you know, when you're involved in the sport of boxing, and you're a dime king fighter. I'll tell you right now, here's a perfect example. You get a guy like Bernard Hopkins. Bernard Hopkins was promoted by Butch Lewis when he started his career.
and then him and Butch Lewis had, you know, a pretty bad, contract split up. And then Hopkins getting that middleweight tournament back in 2000-2001, he had to sign with Don King, and he was with King for a while. They had a real nasty contract breakup, and here's the thing: Bernard Hopkins was still able to be the world champion and still able to continue on with his profession. Just because he wasn't with Don King, he was able to go with Golden Boy, still champion of the world. And then he moves up to light heavyweight, like, for the championship of the world. It's scary when it's like when the league is better and bigger than the fighters. That's big. I mean, and that's one thing that I think will always hurt the world of UFC and mixed martial arts, because if Dana White has a feud with whoever for whatever reason. And somebody's a fighter in the UFC, and he's one of his fighters. Well, you're never going to get that possible dream match. That's, I always think of it back in like the mid to late '80s when Hulk Hogan wrestled in WWF. That was a huge organization, and Ric Flair was with the NWA or WCW. I think it was NWA at the time. And everybody was just talking like Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair. Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair. Well, Vince McMahon was never going to let Hulk Hogan, cross promote with Ted Turner. It was just never going to happen until eventually he let him out of the contract. And that's the only way that ever came about. And I think that's what, and I've said it 1,000 times, Dana White is bigger than his organization. And I think sometimes his ego is bigger than his organization, too.
Yeah, they had that one guy saying that there's something wrong with the sport when Dana White is more recognizable than any of the fighters.
Right.
But,
I mean,
it's what it is.
I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, it always reminds me, in a way, of professional wrestling. It's like, if Vince McMahon, has a feud, like he had a feud with Randy Macho Man Savage over a contract or something, or Savage did something and McMahon fired him back in the 90s. So Savage leaves WCW. WCW eventually folds, but Savage can't come back to WWF. So now you have like great wrestlers in WWF, guys like Bret Hart, guys like Stone Cold Steve Austin or The Rock, and you're never going to see them wrestle a guy like Randy Macho Man Savage, because he was blackballed by Vince McMahon. Now, in the sport of boxing, obviously what soured boxing the last few years was Pacquiao Mayweather never happening. But it wasn't because the fighters are being blackballed by a promoter or an organization. They were being blackballed basically by each other. That was the whole thing. I mean, if you got to a point where, I remember many times growing up, Don King would sit there and he'd have a fighter, that guy was champ of the world. And, well, here was the problem, He had Mike Tyson, but Evander Holyfield was the number one contender. Well, shit, no matter what, either you got to drop your belt and let Holyfield fight for it, which the other number two contender, or you got to fight Evander Holyfield. It can't be, well, Evander Holyfield blackballed by Don King, so he never gets a title shot, or he never gets the post.
Right. Well, moving on, we got to cover a few more stories here. We might go into a little overtime to get through them, but I wanted to at least quickly mention a couple MMA stories and then get to a little bit of boxing. Josh Barnett recently proved Dana White wrong, I guess. Dana White at one point said he would never fight in the UFC again. But he signed a multi-fight deal. And I guess they're looking for him to fight Frank Mir right off the bat, but nothing's official yet. But he's 35 years old, coming in again from Strikeforce. He's had some shadiness in his past with basically some banned substances tests that he tested positive for. But anyway, Dana White was pretty adamant that he's never going to appear in the UFC. Changed his mind, I guess. So he's back.
I like his quote. No heavyweight is safe.
And as Barnett comes back, we have Matt Serra checking out. He's apparently all done. Says he's going to walk away from the sport. Probably best known for his big upset of George St. Pierre after appearing on The Ultimate Fighter. The comeback series there. But he's pretty much ruling out any return to the octagon unless, of course, there's a fight at Madison Square Garden. He's talking about maybe he might come back from if that happens. But it'd probably be at a different weight because I heard that he blew up quite a bit since he's been out of the game. And also, he just had to have a rib removed for some kind of health disregard there. We know if Tom stays on the line, we get overtime. So, in addition to that, one more UFC story before we go to boxing. UFC 161 took a hit this week when interim bantamweight champion Renan Barao was forced out of his fight against Eddie Wineland. And that's scrapping the main event for that card in Winnipeg on June 15th. So the UFC is going to move up the light heavyweight fight between Dan Henderson and Rashad Evans to the headline slot. But it is still, featuring a big hole in the card with one less marquee featured bout. So, with time running out and less than a month to go until the show takes place, the UFC is going to put in the heavyweight Roy Nelson to fill the vacancy, and he's going to be fighting Stipe Miocic. So, pretty interesting. Miocic was actually scheduled for the card against Soa Pelele, but now he's going to face Nelson instead, and no replacement for Pelele has been set yet. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I'd like to really try to get Stipe on for an interview, and now I'm curious about what his strategy will be against Nelson, because Stipe's coming off his first loss, and kind of like to see him in a little bit easier, but it's not the way it's shaken out. And Nelson's very experienced and very hard to stop. In fact, I don't think Nelson's ever been stopped.
Right. Now, we also got to get to a little bit of boxing here. Shane Mosley had a big fight in his comeback fight, his welterweight fight with Pablo Cesar Cano over the weekend. And he's had a year-long layoff after he was supposed to be retiring. And it definitely showed. He said himself, it was tougher than I expected. Connor was a warrior. My experience made the difference. I was out of boxing for a while, and it took me some time to get my rhythm. But in the end, we did things well. And just like Guillermo Jones, Mosley's 41 years old, and he broke a four-fight winless streak with this bout. And he got his first win since beating Antonio Margarito in 2009. At the start, he surprised me, said Mosley, but we could take care of it. My father and trainer, Jack Mosley, kept saying to me, throw your right hook, throw your right, look for body shots. We did this, and things worked out. Cano falls to 26-3-1 with 20 KOs, and he also praised Mosley for his performance and admitted that the veteran's years in the ring were the defining factor. And Cano said his experience was key. By the middle of the fight, he changed. He started boxing. He's still fast, but in the end, I didn't lose to a nobody. I believe I have the talent to ask for more opportunities, and if they offer a rematch, we will gladly accept. And Cano, of course, is a lot younger. He's 23 years old. His only previous losses came to Eric Morales and Pauly Malignaggi. He also said, I heard him a few times. I felt it, but I couldn't finish him up. It was a difficult fight. I thought I made a good impression. I respect the judges, but Mosley told me at the end that a draw would have been fine with him. And it was actually just a two-point victory on all three cards, 115 to 113 for Mosley. And Mosley said he's going to rest up. Right now, I don't know what will happen. But he's definitely going to continue fighting, according to his Twitter account anyway. And talking about seeking a world title shot, but we'll see about that. kickboxing story. Audley Harrison is unretired. Just talked about it. Retired.
One round 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Like, that was the quickest ever, I think, decision to come back. And this is kind of a different reason. You don't usually see this reason, but apparently he has a son. And his impression on having a son was, he couldn't bear to have his son see him as a quitter. So he decided he's coming back for good. Or, well, not for good, obviously, but for as long as he can, I bet. So we'll see what happens there. There's no way I'm going to tell my son I gave up because I didn't want to climb the mountain again. I didn't want to dust myself off again when I'm now in the best shape of my career, doing things I haven't done for years and back in love with the sport. How can I retire when I know I have another shot in me? If I don't get up and try again, everything I've stood for would mean nothing. Setbacks pave the way for comebacks, et cetera, et cetera. I believe it, so I have to live it and go again. So, also he said he can't walk away with that performance in his last fight. And if I do, it would haunt me until I'm old and gray. I got up, they should have let him come to finish me and let me show what I got. And he says, for people who worry I may get hurt, I thank you for your concerns. We live in a free society and my desire for freedom and autonomy is my universal right. Now, nothing has been set in stone yet, but he says, wherever it is, you'll see him in a ring soon. Another story here about Fallon Fox. We've actually been working on trying to get her as a guest on the show, or him, however you want to look at it. But she came out in a recent interview saying that she's actually at a disadvantage. And she's got some interesting pointers for this, some background information here from medical people. She had reassignment surgery and all that. But she's also on this hormone replacement surgery, or treatment, actually. I don't think it's a surgery. I think the article made a mistake there in calling it a surgery. But back in 2002 and 2003, she started on this hormone replacement therapy. And she continues to take the hormone treatments to this day. And the perspective on this says she has to take the estrogen or she could get osteoporosis. So any woman she's competing against, she'll have drastically lower testosterone levels than they will. Almost nothing, according to her. And also there was a Dr. Marcy Bowers, who was a gender reassignment surgeon, who, believe it or not, has also undergone the procedure herself. Concurred. It's very weird to hear that one. She says if you measure Fox's endurance and her strength, it's actually that of a comparable woman of the same age. What happens is after surgery, patients actually regress and that their bone density drops to what a comparable woman of her size would be. When you test her, she's going to come out with low testosterone levels and muscle mass that is remarkably similar to her counterparts. She's got an upcoming fight here. It's CFA 11. I don't know exactly what CFA stands for. I don't see it here in the article, but I think it's a Florida organization. But she's had some mixed reactions from people in that organization. Peggy Morgan, who is one of the favorites in the tournament, told MMA Weekly that I understand it's necessary to protect Fox's rights and make sure that she's being treated fairly, and I do think that it's something that should happen, but I feel like our safety should be protected as well. And they also, Morgan and her trainer actually had a more inflammatory video about Fox that was much less reserved. And John Fain was the trainer who said that Fallon Fox is not Rosa Parks. He lied on his Florida state application to fight and as a result assaulted an unknowing woman in the cage. This is a total lack of character and integrity. We are not afraid of Fallon Fox, but we are not going to fight him. And her CFA 11 opponent, Alana Jones, hasn't been nearly as critical or as vocal. She says, I'm so used to training with people bigger than me, so I look at it as another fight. I feel it could be a physical advantage, but once I get in the cage with her, I might not be able to tell. It is what it is, basically. So Fox maintains it's not just her opinion here, but it's the medical community's opinion as well. Although, I guess if you're a gender reassignment surgery surgeon who's had the procedure yourself, you might be a little biased.
You think?
Yeah. Very strange there. Now, I guess the last thing we'll cover, if I can find it, is this Jacob Volkman story. I think it might be in another notes section. There it is. All right, so Jacob Volkman left the UFC. He was cut. Not sure if it was in that that time period where Dana White had said, you know, we need to spill some blood. Literally, that's what he said. Not very professional, in my opinion, but who's ever said Dana White's been professional? Anyway, he's spoken out recently. He talked to Above and Beyond MMA, and he said he's very bitter. They always claim that they treat their fighters so well. Yeah, they treat the top 5% of the fighters well, the ones that are on the main card all the time. They don't treat the rest of them very well. The healthcare plan is horrible, with a $1,500 deductible per injury. The catastrophic injury insurance is not even really good insurance. There's no retirement fund. There's no signing bonus. You start off at 6-6, and it's just $6,000 to show and $6,000 to win, I think. You're really not making too much money because you're self-employed, so you're paying the self-employment tax, and you're paying the regular tax and income tax, so you're paying twice as much in tax. They claim they're treating the fighters well, but they're not, realistically. People always tell me, you're rich, you're on TV. Are you kidding me? I made $54,000 2 years ago, paid $9,000 in taxes, so that leaves me at $45,000. This last year, I made $50,000, paid $8,000 in taxes. That leaves me with $42,000. That's barely above poverty. I have 3 kids and a wife I'm supporting. I'm trying to make the fans realize what the UFC is really like. I'm going to expose them as much as I can. But also, my goal is to win in World Series, which is currently, and try to stay undefeated. Obviously, it's to win. The short-term goal is to win. The long-term goal is, as soon as they come out with that belt, I'd like to get that belt. So Volkman's last fight was a loss to Strikeforce import Bobby Green at the UFC 156 pay-per-view event earlier this year. It was his second submission loss in the span of 3 fights, but just his second defeat since early 2010 when he rebounded with 5 consecutive victories. His untimely release may have been a bit more surprising had it not come around the time that former welterweight number one contender John Fitch was put out to pasture. Regardless, he'll have a second chance to make his mark in the MMA on June 14th in Sin City. That'll keep him above the poverty level. So, that's about it for this week, I think. Unless you guys have any comments, we haven't covered.
I was talking about a big boxing match coming up this weekend. Mini-Mac, Carl Flach, and Mikhail Kessler, which was during the Super 6 tournament. Kessler edges him out, winning a decision. I think the Fox is the favorite this time around. The Fox got a little out of control at the press conference. You know, he's pointing at Kessler, and I'm going to kill this, you know, mother effer, and, you know, you don't need that. You don't need to be, you know, getting all, you know, bullshitty like that. You know, it's a sport, and let's keep it that way. Yeah, I know he's promoting the fight and everything, but I was never a big fan of, talking like that. And, so we could pull up the records real quick. I don't think we really have anything else significant going on this weekend. Except if you guys want to go to the Harleysville Parade, which I know is very exciting, because I'm going to be on one of the floats. Yeah, I'm going to be on a float because I'm popular and handsome. he's 30 wins, 2 losses, with 22 knockouts. His two losses, a unanimous decision to Mikkel Kessler back in 2010, and then a unanimous decision to Andre Ward back in 2011. Since then, he's had, this is actually almost going to be a year to the day since his big knockout win over Lucien Bouffier, and then followed that up back in November with a pretty devastating knockout over Yusuf Mack. Mikkel Kessler from Denmark is 46-2 with 35 knockouts. Since the loss to Andre Ward, which was his decision back in 2009, his two losses were to Joe Calzaghe, unanimous decision in 07, and then Andre Ward back in 2009. Since then, he's had the win over Carl Crotch, unanimous decision, and then he's had three knockout wins. He's had Mede Bouzois, Alan Green, who was he knocked out very impressively. That was just about a year ago. And then Brian McGee, who he knocked out in three rounds back in December. But I got to say, Frost is the fighter playing the hot hand right now. And looking at Kessler, it looks like he's just slowed down just a little bit. I mean, granted, since his decision win, 3 years ago, it looks like he slowed down. And I see Frost getting in this time. Does he need to do a rubber match? Maybe. I know Kessler temporarily retired for a while due to some eye issues. I think it was a detached retina, but he came back from that. I just see Frost being the more active guy and the guy playing the hot hand.
Well, guess what, Tony? I just found an email from Dylan Amadeo from 2009.
Okay.
And it says, Rich, Tony Pinnacal suggested that I contact you.
No shit.
Yeah. So you introduced me to before Nick did. And he says, I believe that you have a copy of my first book, Voices of Hell's Kitchen, currently on Amazon.com. And this, I guess, is before he wrote anything about Ken Norton or Rayco Saunders, but he had all that stuff in the works. Interesting. Small world. Anyway, I definitely will have to go through this UFC 160 card. UFC 160 is happening on Saturday here. I don't have the
exact. I remember for a long time, like when I first started co-hosting with you a couple of years ago, I was more active in booking interviews. I had more time, and I wasn't involved in as many things. I mean, I don't know what I'm involved in now, but I feel like I'm always busy. I don't know why. Then it got to the point where it was like I would get people to say, yeah, I want to do it, but then I would always kind of forward to you to put them on the schedule. And I think that's when we were starting to hit the format of trying to sometimes get different time slots. I don't know if I found him, because I was even still using MySpace at that time in 2009. So I don't know if I found him on a MySpace page or through Facebook, or maybe just even a chat room, and I'm going to show with you guys. Okay, and talk to Rich. We'll put you on the schedule.
Sorry, just had to let my cat out. I don't know if you could hear him in the background there.
I could.
Meowing.
I'm trying to get one into a radio contest. I heard they got a radio contest for dog, like who can get their dog to bark the most in like 15 seconds. Just like dog will smoke any other dog out there. But like I had him at the park yesterday, and another dog, he was playing with this other dog that he sees all the time. He was like a chocolate lab, and she got his stick, and he like a 11-year-old dog to a temper tantrum.
Well, if they ever have one for cats and meowing, I think mine would win hands down. I just have to hold up a can of cat food. You won't.
Nice.
But anyway, I got to get to 160 here. UFC 160, big main event. Cain Velasquez versus Bigfoot, Antonio Silva. And Velasquez has only one loss there to Junior Dos Santos. Silva has four, but he's had some impressive wins lately. He's 18-4. Velasquez is 11-1. It's going to be a super fight here. Talk about, you know, Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao. This is that for MMA and more. It's a big time heavyweight fight here. And it's probably the first time in a long time where we've had two fights at the top of the card with really the top heavyweights in the world right now. Junior Dos Santos fighting Mark Hunt, too. You know, we're going to see if Mark Hunt's victory over Stefan Struve was just a fluke or a real deal. Hunt has a pretty deceiving record. He's only 9-7 compared to Junior Dos Santos, and his 15-2 mark for record there, but I think this is going to be a barn burner.
You know, I think as far as the main event goes, the question is, what will Silva do different this time? Will he be able to stop the takedown? And even if the fight stays on the feet, I noticed that Silva's trainer was saying, this guy is so strong, he doesn't know how strong he is. And I'm thinking, if this were a powerlifting meet or a strongman event, that's great. But in a fight, as all of us know, there's a little more to it than strength. And I think that Kane just has a better stand-up. I mean, yeah, maybe Bigfoot hits a little harder, but Kane just has that boxing smoothness to him. He puts things together good, and to me, it's just, I don't see what Silva's going to do different. We'll see if I'm right.
Well, I would bet that one thing he's going to do differently is not bleed like a stuck pig.
Well, I mean, it depends now. If he's taken down and pulls guard, he didn't seem to really have an answer for it the first time.
Right.
So we'll see.
If, I mean, that cut was huge, and I think they actually even accused Kane the last time of an illegal blow that caused it. But I might be wrong on that. But anyway, well, they said that those type of elbows, I think, should be outlawed because they're too damaging. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of things you could do differently. I think obviously the big fight with Overeem there was probably more because Overeem was too overconfident and a little too cocky than anything, but still, it's a very stiff competition to beat like that, and obviously we've seen Cain Velasquez come back from getting beat by Junior Dos Santos and regain the championship, so anything is possible. And
Oh, of course. I mean, a guy that big and strong is dangerous. But I do think that Kane has the right mindset. He's not looking past this fight. He's not looking past him at all. And, of course,
I'm going to take Antonio. We'll see his direct sidekick
time. Well, okay. We'll see how it goes. All right. And then the with Junior, this is a fascinating fight, too. Junior may have to go to the ground on this. I mean, if Mark Hunt just seems to have a coconut head. I mean, his chin is just off the charts, because I probably mentioned this to you before, but a guy that I've trained with up at our gym years ago, Dan Bobich, fought Mark Hunt in Pride. And Bobich, either one of you guys have seen him fight, Bobich was too heavy for the UFC. He usually weighed in around 340, and he was pretty solid. And he had Hunt on the ground, and this has got to be it, he couldn't finish him off. So, this is going to be a very interesting fight. But then the question is, can Hunt finish Junior off after the beating that Junior took the last time from Kane? If nothing else, he proved he can take punishment. So, this is an intriguing fight, and Hunt's definitely a live body here.
Right. Well, we'll have to see, too, if Junior comes in a little bit gun-shy and more cautious because of that fight with Kane and, you know, just getting tossed around the ring like that. And Mark obviously can rattle him if he can connect with him, but Dos Santos is also known as one of the best boxers in MMA, so...
Yeah, maybe the best, yeah, And he also had said that there was a problem with his training for Kane. I don't know if you've caught the news on that, but he really had a legitimate medical condition that was supposedly a direct consequence of ridiculous overtraining, having like 2-3 hour sessions every day and having camp for 3 months, and his body just redlined. At least that's what that's.
I
what
know he also
said.
Came out and said he had a ton of emotional family type problems too going on at the same time. So